Meeting will come to order. Representative Mason moves the minutes from March 19th. Has anybody had a chance to look at those, read them clearly, and we're all set to do on it? No any corrections or additions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All same sign, we have the minutes. And we're going to do a little shift in the agenda. We're going to House File 3219 to begin with. Metropolitan Airports Commission required to monitor noise to establish a baseline. Representative Mason, would you care to assume the gavel? Yeah. You can do it from here, given the crowded nature of this room. We like to sweat you people early in the morning. That's why we invited you to this room. There are many more spacious rooms that are not available, so we thought we'd invite you here anyway. All right. House File 3219 is an outgrowth of some new technology and some concerned constituents all the way around the city of Minneapolis here. New technology is a system called RNAV, which stands for Area Navigation Systems, and it's a system that monitors continuously flights of ongoing up and downcoming airlines, air flights, and there's some concern that this may cause extra noise where no noise existed. Everybody that, in fact, I think anybody real estate people here are required to suggest to their customers that when you buy a house, you should also investigate many things like the school district, how many airplanes are flying over, and a number of other things. So it's not unusual to wake up one morning, I suppose, if you didn't read the instructions that the real estate person gave you and find that there was an airplane flying over your head. And maybe if you're out in the garden, it might cause more noise than otherwise. But there has been a system of checking on various flights here and there, and this has been long argued in Minneapolis. There have been a great number of checks of where and how high and how long the flights were over, and a great deal of insulation and money spent to improve the noise factor in the particular areas of South Minneapolis off the end of the runways. We find also that there's some worry now because RNAV is coming in and it may change flight patterns. At the present time, the FAA, of course, is the one who is in charge of determining whether they're going to install the system or not. They came up to the brink of installing it after a great deal of consternation from a number of people that perceived that they would be in the way of the airplanes and the new ones. The FAA backed off, and the takeoffs are not going to be done with the RNAV system. There are good reasons for RNAV, and fuel saving and safety, among others. But nevertheless, we are entering this bill which would cause the Metropolitan Air Force Commission to do a study that monitors aircraft noise levels for a period of 2 weeks in the summer or fall of 2014. And they would be doing it on an extended basis beyond the L30 and L30 and 31? 30R and 30L, left and right. That's good. I should remember that. To the west. And so we've asked, we're actually directing the Metropolitan Airports Commission to do a study that would include the locations to the west-northwest, which are prescribed by the areas of I-94 on the south, Xerxes Avenue on the east, from the intersection of I-94 and Xerxes Avenue, extending a straight line north to I-34 and I-34 on the north, and Trunk Highway 69 on the west. That takes in two cities, maybe a little smidge of Minneapolis, but basically it takes in Edina and St. Louis Park. The specific location of the monitor shall be determined by the cities within the areas in consultation with the commission. No monitor may be within 2 miles of another permanent noise monitor. These are temporary, as we said, for 2 weeks. The permanent ones have been in place forever in a day since they started monitoring, basically in South Minneapolis. And we ask that we do not overlap, because the radius of these things is 2 miles, and we don't want, so we say no monitor may be within 2 miles of another permanent noise monitor. And the commission shall report to the cities within the area and to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committee with jurisdiction over transportation policy and finance. The results of the noise monitoring and the baseline data for aircraft noise in the area. The final report is due December 1. We're going to establish a baseline so that folks who have been know that they have air noise over their areas and have known this for a long time are now beginning to imagine that this that our NAV is already in place and this noise is greatly in excess of what they remember. And as far as we know, that there are no RNAV directions, am I correct on that, that have taken place on takeoffs, and they have delayed their process for how much time, I don't know. But we'll probably hear about that from Mac. So that's the essence of the bill. I know that the Metropolitan Airports Commission would like to speak to this. So whoever is here and represents them, I'd be happy to hear from them.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name, please.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and thanks for giving us a chance to comment on the bill. Just a couple of quick remarks. First of all, we want to make sure that the committee understands that the Airports Commission today has probably one of the most extensive noise and monitoring systems in the country yet placed at Minneapolis International Airport. It's really recognized as second to none in the world for what we do monitor and how we monitor aircraft operations in conjunction with noise and departures, and it gives us a good base and a good factual information to study for those that look close at these issues. For the committee, we literally get dozens of requests for noise monitors, temporary or portable monitors, every year. The requests come from individual residents or community groups or even cities on a regular basis to have additional monitors placed out in the communities. Recently we have received requests as far out as west of Lake Minnetonka for monitoring, or even in Shakopee for people that want to have monitors placed out there to kind of show that it's louder in their area than it's been, or that there's been some changes. We take real good technical look at these issues through the Noise Oversight Committee to decide what is the best way to kind of do this monitoring, and we don't just kind of chase around all over the place. And we just present some caution to the committee: if the state legislature is going to get involved with this discussion, I think that the legislature and this committee in particular is going to need to set a lot of time aside in the future for discussing where noise monitors should be and how they should be conducted and what matrix should be used and all kinds of things. And so if the committee wants to go down the path of kind of directing groups in the future to measure noise, you've got other airports in the state or in the metro area like Flying Cloud and Anoka County that also have these types of concerns, that you'll be hearing these issues, I think, in the future. With that said, we've had some good discussions with the author of the bill. We know we're at committee deadline, and I think that his pleasure is to keep the bill moving forward to keep those discussions going. There's increased sensitivity out in this particular area because of the proposed FAA new routing of aircraft off of MSP. And so there's kind of an increased heightened awareness out there right now. And so we're kind of willing to keep the discussion going and seeing if there's some way that we can meet the community's needs out there and see if there's something that we can do if this does progress.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple questions for Mr. Killian. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate your doing this bill. We have, of course, noise issues in Minneapolis, but as I looked at the map of the existing noise monitors and then the 60 and 64 DNL, it did seem that there were a couple of holes. South of the north-south runway in Bloomington, I think there was only one monitor, and then there was, you know, the DNL contour goes quite a bit further south of that particular monitor. Also on the parallel runways in Eagan and Mendota Heights. And then along the river in Minneapolis. And the reason I mentioned the river in Minneapolis is I understand that might have been one of the RNAV routes. And I can't immediately picture the arrival. We're appreciative that the departure RNAV, vectors are not in place, at least right now. But there are some arrival ones. And so my question is, are there additional areas where you feel if we're going to go down this road of monitoring, which I think is a good one, because citizens need the information, and there are some holes, apparently, it looks like, that you would even acknowledge. Do you see also some holes in these areas that I've described?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, is a really good question because it's an ongoing question as things change at the airport again. Where should you place these monitors and what happens? And to give you a little bit of background, it's not the airport's commission that just goes out and kind of heavy-handedly decides where to put the monitors. We use a noise oversight committee that's made up of communities that are most impacted by noise around the airport, along with the airlines, and looking at departure procedures and routes. We have 39 permanent monitors at our airport today. That's the most of any airport in the world. Atlanta Airport has 16, and that's the busiest airport in the world. They currently have 16, and that's a very urban setting one. But to address your question, I think that the Noise Oversight Committee will continue to look at holes and whether or not the monitoring system that we have in place today is right. These issues around RNAV have raised the issue, and that we'll continue to kind of look at, is there gaps or are there changes in patterns that we need to look at? But they've been really kind of placed strategically in the departure and arrival routes to make sure that we get those areas. And the piece that I would add is, even if you don't have a noise monitor out there to cover it, as you get further away from the airport, we do have the flight track data, because we have the data straight from the air route the traffic control tower. So you might not have a monitor in your community, but we have the data from exactly what airplanes fly over your area. So we can literally draw a gate in with a mile of a home or a residence, and we might not have a monitor in those areas, but we can really see exactly how many flights or if it's changed. We can do a three-month window, a one-week window to look at them. But I think for your question, the Noise Oversight Committee is monitoring these hearings and this discussion, and they will continue to look at that.
Madam Chair, I have a quick follow-up. And I don't know if members of the public of the committee know this, but apparently you can, in real time, actually see the flight patterns. I don't know if it's an app or anything. I'm not sort of an app kind of guy, but you can. I think there is some kind of a link where you can see that, and that's where I saw actually the other day. There were departures on the north-south runway going north-south. The wind was coming out of the south, and I guess the pilots would say we're taking off to the south. And I saw a lot of green, which indicated departure flights, and not a noise monitor over those. So there clearly are gaps, and so I hope that as we look at this issue, we try to fill those gaps, especially because, as you said, Mr. Killian, I think correctly, that we are going to have different patterns now with RNAV, and those might not include monitors. One other just quick idea that I have, it's not in the bill, but it's something I think as the MAC does these kinds of studies, we may want to keep in mind. The Met Council did some supplemental analysis of Southwest LRT, and as they were doing these studies, they had community meetings where people were able to look at drafts of the studies and talk with the consultants and others in the Met Council about, you know, the methodology and give their point of view. So I hope you'll consider in this study that maybe to have a community meeting and it looks like St. Louis Park or Edina is where this is going to be, so that the citizens can engage with you about the study and where you're going with it. I thought it was really effective, there was a good back and forth between, you know, the Met Council and the citizenry. So I hope that you would consider, you know, maybe having an interim draft report of this, putting it out to the public and having a community meeting. Of course, that community meeting should be outside of the airport security boundary. But just a couple of thoughts about that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Killian, just a quick question. I'm kind of curious. I realize this is a policy committee hearing, but do you know the approximate cost of one of these temporary units for a two-week period?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, it's a little bit rough to make that estimate. We have, if we were going to do these temporary three monitors, we have the equipment because we've done this before at some of our smaller airports and some things. The rough cost that we would kind of throw out there is someplace between $6,000 and $12,000. And the piece that makes it a little bit questionable and not sure is we have in-house staff that it takes technical expertise to these. You don't just send some interns out. And then writing the report takes a lot of time because there'll be a real report that comes out of this that ties back to flight track data and does some things. But in-house, we have a fairly small staff, and we have an employee going out on maternity leave. We have another employee that has a job offer, potentially, that's the technical expertise. And so if we're going to get this done in the time frame, if you really move to doing this through a contract service, you could be looking at three times the dollar amount that I've said versus trying to do it in-house, and we will try to do it in-house and try to work it through. But there are some logistical pieces that we have to work through on.
Representative Rosenthal. Thank you. Members, Representative Earhart wants to refer this to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and this will be going to the General Register.
Thank you.
Okay, are we doing the next study?
The next bill is House File 2881, Mason.
I know we have a number. Chair, members, in light of the fact that we're in kind of a restricted space, I'll do it from the table as well. Mr. Brown, if you will take the table. Members, Chair, thank you so much for hearing this bill. The intent... Should I start?
Okay, we are... Boy, did you do the amendment? I'm sorry, I was listening to my...
First of all, do you want to move 2881 to the Transportation Finance?
Okay.
Okay, and then...
Do you want to add the amendment?
Are we doing any... Okay. Okay, and I am going to move Amendment A1 to get the bill in the shape that we would like to have.
All right, all those in favor of Amendment A1, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You have your whole bill before us.
Thank you so much. This bill will clarify the intent of the Motor Carriers of Railroad Employees, the Railroad Employees Law. Motor carriers will be brought into compliance with existing law. Drivers will be brought to the higher standards required for driving railroad crews in all weathers. and road conditions, and this will address the concerns of training and standards for a safe driver and safe vehicles. Some of the things that are included in the amendment will be vision requirements addressing night blindness, pre-trip and post-trip inspections of the vehicle, hours of service and on-duty time are better refined, restricts the use of cellular phones, clarifies existing law to include criminal and vehicular background checks. I was just going to say background checks. That would have been easier. Also, maintaining ongoing file of training, licensing, and record-keeping requirements for drivers, and maintaining vehicle maintenance records. There's a number of other things as well, including a testing program for drug and alcohol. But again, because I know we're in time constraints, what I'd like to do at this point is turn it over to Mr. Brown.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is David Brown. I am the Minnesota State Legislative Board Chairman and National Region 3 Legislative Chairman of the National Association of State Legislative Board Chairman. The Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, founding member of the Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Rail Conference. From the beginning of our organization back in 1863, the BLE has worked with industry, the government, and other railroad unions to make certain that railroads provide for the safety of our members, the public, and the environment. On behalf of more than 40,000 active BLE team members, over 150,000 International Brotherhood of Teamsters Rail Conference members, and over 1.4 million members of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, I want to express my appreciation for the opportunity to provide this committee with testimony for moving House File 2881 forward. I'm not sure how much aware that you are of the certain lingo of the rail industry. In the railroad terminology, you're slang, if you will, deadhead is when a crew or individual is transporting to a train or terminal under the hours of service, or dead in the hours of service, or just going to or from terminals to perform service. An employee is referred to as dead when he or she has worked up to the hours of service and can no longer legally, under federal law, perform service for the railroad. The crew hauler is the driver of a van of a contracted motor carrier railroad employees that can haul up to 8 passengers. The railroad crews were usually deadheaded by train, but with the influx of amount of traffic that has increased over the years, they have been contracted out to van companies.
Mr. Chair, we do not have a bill.
There's a lot of pieces, Mr. Chairman, to the bill. It does help.
Counselor?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe the committee administrator is going to make copies of this bill.
Okay. Please proceed. We'll get you a copy of it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Begin off with the type of transportation that we are using now. The motor carriers, the contracted motor carriers of railroad employees transport train crews from train to train, yard to yard, town to town, within the state and out to our bordering states. The distance is as short as from the yard office to the train, less than a mile or a roundhouse a couple city blocks away. To get to the locomotives or train to as far away as Minneapolis, Dilworth, Fargo, Wilmer, Superior, La Crosse, Wisconsin, Mason City, Iowa, Mandan, North Dakota, Minot, North Dakota, or even to Glenwood or St. Paul, Minnesota, and all points between hundreds of miles. The driving area is anywhere the railroad tracks run day or night in all types of weather conditions with a driver on call and not sure when to get the rest needed to perform. They are subject to call exactly as we are on the extra boards and the pull turns. At this time, Professional Transportation Industries and its subcontractors are service providers for the Canadian Pacific, Canadian National, Union Pacific, and BNSF railroads in the state of Minnesota and surrounding states. The crew van drivers that haul what I wish to believe to my family as very important precious cargo, that would be me, they work on all call and all shifts, day and night, running in all types of weather and road conditions and traffic. They work a schedule paralleling to mine. At this time, these drivers and vehicles they drive are only required to pass company policy requirements, not all the state or federal standards. This legislation will close loopholes and gray areas of existing law and require companies to conduct business in Minnesota to be held responsible. To have Minnesota law enforcement agencies hold these companies accountable to abide by the existing laws this legislation addresses, this legislation will ensure and provide for safer transportation of railroad employees, for safe drivers and their vehicles that travel on the roads of Minnesota, next to your families, your neighbors, and yourselves. This legislation is needed to enhance the motor carriers of railroad employees, existing law. The checks and balances are enforced by the agencies that this amendment addresses. And to cut it short, thank you for the opportunity to bring my testimony forward, and esteemed members of this committee, I'm available for any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Brown? Next, I think, well, not next on the list is a lady from Red Wing, Ms. Schaubach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, I did grow up in Red Wing, so ran very many times down by the railroad, so this is kind of near and dear to my heart. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We are a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliate unions, representing more than 300,000 working people throughout the state. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2881 to improve and clarify the intent of the Motor Carriers Railroad Employees Law. First and foremost, worker safety and health is a priority of the American labor movement. With this bill, as Representative Mason said before, the motor carriers will be brought into compliance with existing law, and drivers will be brought to the higher standards required for driving railroad crews. This safety and the safety of all Minnesotans on our roads is key. Any worker death or injury is one too many. And the Minnesota AFL-CIO and its affiliate unions stand with our union brothers and sisters that work on the railroads in support of House File 2881. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Schaubach? Who's next? I don't know.
Okay, are the two people from the law firm here? Or do you want them just for extras? I'm sorry.
Mr. Brown.
Mason. Bill Cabas from the law firm is here available if you wish it for him to give the money.
May I suggest that one of the things you might mention is some of the accidents that have happened? We've talked about it, and that might be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, Mason, I have, I believe I there should be a PowerPoint in your packets that was handed out.
Do we have that?
And I don't have one in front of me, but yeah, that would be it, Mr. Chairman.
This one?
No, I'm fine. I pretty much know. If you would look towards the back few, the back page, it would bring it back basically to home. Of the we've had fatalities.
Please, Bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had fatalities. We've had just as recently we had a rollover with a crew on the way to Dilworth, Minnesota, from Minneapolis, Minnesota. The crew is still out of not out of the woods. There were injuries. What occurred is the driver fell asleep. The crew had been up for over 24 hours. As I had mentioned in my earlier testimony, that at times we are subject to call, and we may be up for 8 to 12 hours prior to going to work for 12 hours, much less waiting for transportation, even beyond that point. And so what occurred was the crew was exhausted, and apparently the van driver was also exhausted because of his hours that he's being kept, and he fell asleep, rolled over in the ditch. We had two fatalities. I may turn over this, the exact fatalities that we had in Mandan on a crew van that was going to Minot. We had fatalities in Washington State. Had fatalities in Texas. All due to, some was due to equipment, some was due to driver error. Some has been done from, we're driving the roads. People get hit by, there's drunk drivers out there. There's black ice. There's all the conditions that we find that we have to do in our own daily lives. But we're doing it a hundredfold day and night in all hours, all types of weather, all types of roads. And so there has been many unfortunate incidents where railroad employees have no longer been able to enjoy their careers, because we are our careers. If we can't just change a craft once we become an operating craft, a train engineer, a switchman, it's very difficult for us to find another job if we are injured.
Thank you.
My name is William Gavas. I'm designated counsel for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. And the nature of my practice is representing injured railroad workers. I've seen what the effect of van drivers and van accidents have been. We represent the widows in North Dakota from the collision. We represent those who have been crippled and maimed in these accidents. These are railroad workers who are highly skilled individuals and highly paid individuals. Injuries have significant consequences for them, because if they are unable to do their job, many of whom are earning upwards of $100,000 a year, do not have another place to turn. One of the things we find with our vocational counselors we work with, these people don't have transferable skills that allow them easily following an injury to move to another occupation. And the reason that this ban legislation is so important is because of the risks that they face that are different. The railroad is an industry that operates 24/7. It never shuts down. Their trains are always moving. To keep those trains moving requires them to shuttle employees to trains that go dead. And by that I mean, when a railroad employee, an engineer conductor, reaches 12 hours of service, they're done. That train must stop at that time at any location. And when it is stopped, that crew has to be picked up and brought by van back to another location, and a van must bring a crew out. And that means they can be bringing them out at 2 o'clock in the morning. They can be bringing them out in the middle of a blizzard. The weather conditions don't dictate when these van drivers go. The needs of the railroads in moving the crews to the trains to get them moving is what is paramount. This isn't like a driver that, for example, if you're sitting in your office and it's snowing and you decide, you know what, I'm going to wait for an hour for the storm to pass. That luxury doesn't exist with respect to these individuals. So for that reason, the protections that are provided in the bill at least provide some assurance regarding the qualifications of the drivers that are going to be doing this, and to make sure the steps are taken to provide the safety that we know can be provided. Because in too many circumstances, we have individuals that we represent who have had van drivers that fall asleep, that lose attention, because they're not getting the proper rest, because it's not being required. And I would forcefully argue in support of the bill and hope for its ultimate passage.
Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Voss?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh,
Petersburg.
Representative
Petersburg. A question that may impact him or not, but can you remind me where this is going after this bill?
Transportation Finance.
Okay. We can talk about that. Thanks.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Mr. Voss, did you say it was?
Voss.
Yes. Voss. Okay. Just for the committees, because this is the policy committee, the committee says enlightenment. Remind us that when a crew is in the crew van and being transported and something happens, to whom do they have recourse, the van company or the railroad that they work for?
It's a very good question, because what it boils down to is when you do have a motor vehicle accident, there is a question of, is there fault of the van driver, and is there fault of another involved vehicle? In many circumstances, you have a van that is struck by another motor vehicle operated by an individual who may have many limits. $30,000 or $50,000 policy can be wholly inadequate to compensate for the losses, which in these cases can reach seven figures. What it does then is under the Federal Employers Liability Act, which is the act that protects railroaders who are injured on the job, they have the ability to commence a claim against the railroad, but in order to do that, they must prove the negligence of the railroad, and the van company is their agent for that purpose. And one of the purposes in arguing for, and I know that there was an earlier amendment to raise the underinsured motorist coverage to $5 million, one of the purposes for that is to eliminate the claims that have to be made against the railroads in these types of circumstances. It is lengthy and protracted litigation. It's something that's quite frankly expensive for us and for our clients. It's expensive for the railroads, all of which gets remedied if underinsured motorist coverage is provided, and it's cheap coverage. This is not as if it is an expensive proposition. It is something that then means that you have less litigation, you have fewer claims, you take those claims out of the court system and allow them to be resolved through the underinsured motorist process, and ultimately through the other steps in the bill also advance the safety and hopefully reduce the incidents.
Mr. Chairman? Then I apologize for being a little late, but I'm assuming that the A1 amendment was adopted, and is that the case?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can hold my other committee or questions till Transportation Finance then. Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, if I could just
Mr. Brown.
Comment. Just on the BNSF alone, these van companies travel over 90 million miles. That's just on the BNSF alone. All the national Class 1, Class 2 railroads use these van companies.
Everything Mason, you have.
Okay. What I'd like to do then is move this 2881 to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Everything Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I get a little more information about... There talks about a reference to the code on conviction 609.02. It's a criminal code. It would appear that this should go to civil law or judiciary. Is that
Council. Mr. Bruce.
Mr. Chair and members, the change in definitions starting on 2.1, creating a new subdivision on definitions, includes defining the term convictions. That's actually in current law, and it's a technical change to move definitions to the beginning of the section. So you'll see the equivalent conviction definition on 5.32 being stricken. On-duty time is also a term that's being moved. That term is being defined somewhat differently, but conviction is the definition for that, the cross-reference, is the same as current law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to ask, though, also about the fact that these inspections can occur without a search warrant. I was just wondering if that might be another reason to send this on to judiciary or civil law.
Mr. Bears? Are we changing something here or what?
Mr. Chair, offhand, I guess I don't have a... response on that. Just give me a minute for a little bit of analysis.
Okay. Have you got time to do that now, or is this is going to, where is it going?
Transportation Finance.
It's going to Finance. What? Okay. Do we have any other testifiers?
Well, I was just going to say, again, subdivision 9 at the back also talks about state patrol and authority to enter, and so, again, that's another area where it may be concerning for us to maybe go to civil law or some other place before it goes to finance. So just another piece for you to look at.
How do you feel about that, Mr. Burtis? No reason why we can't go to finance and then wherever we might discover that it should go.
I don't
think.
Mr. Chair, that could be a path for the bill to take, is to go to finance first, and then if the finance and policy committee felt that this was a provision that they wanted to review, they could take a look at it as well. The State Patrol is under the purview generally of the transportation committees, but obviously as public safety issues come up, particularly criminal law type issues come up, the public safety committee also has jurisdiction and interest in that.
Let's wait a minute. I sent Matt Shearer off to check on one of those with somebody who has a lot of me, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, while we're waiting, can I inquire as to any opposition to the bill? I noticed some testifiers in favor. Anyone else want to speak about the bill, or is everybody cool with things?
I haven't asked yet, but I don't know what Mason has in mind.
Is Mr. Cox here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, no, he is not.
Is he stuck on a train somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Brown.
Yes.
Oh, he is, actually. Okay. Been there, done that. Yes.
Mark Anderson is not here.
I'm here.
Well, you're on the list. I don't know. It's up to
right. If
the author.
If you have comments, this would be appropriate.
Mr. Anderson.
My name is Mark Anderson. I'm a locomotive engineer on the Union Pacific Railroad and have done so for 22 years. I spent a lot of time riding or sitting waiting in crew vans. I've had a lot of incidents happen in crew vans. I've had my foot run over. I've had them put the vehicle in reverse when I'm putting my bags in the back. I've had them change lanes into a lane that's occupied. In fact, in a 5-month period, 7 times. And in one case, forcing a fellow over onto the shoulder as he was honking and swerving to avoid it. Things happen. We're very fortunate that locally we haven't had many more worse things happen. When I think of this and when I do things and what we do, our attempt is to make the lives of ourselves and those whom we work with better. My wife and 6 children like me to come home every few days because that's how it is on the railroad. I get a phone call, I'm at work in a couple hours, and I get home in 2 or 3 days. My time in between is on a train or in a motel room. Of course, when I come home, I probably got to my away from home. I probably slept and then was up for several hours and then got called to work and then worked 12 plus hours. Now I come home and I'm tired and I'm grumpy and, gee, Dad, we're glad to see you. This is the way our lives are. My children know nothing different. I've done it for all of their lives. It's difficult. It's also rewarding, but it comes with risk. Anything that we can do to eliminate the risk, to eliminate the cause of my family if something happens to me, having to sell the house, go to public housing, and live on welfare, I think is a good thing. Because that's what would quite frankly occur in our lives if something happened to me in a crew van and I was not able to work again. My wife would not be able to support our children. Our college dreams would be dead. Probably older children would have to be going to work. An incredible change in their lives. It's not a get-rich thing. It's a get-by thing. It's a try and continue on. I'm very much in support of House File 2881, and I would urge it to pass it and move it to the next committee. Hopefully we can make it a part of Minnesota law, show that we care for those who are out. They tell me I can't go on strike because the economy fails if I don't go to work. So support us in what we do. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Thank you.
No, at this point, I do not. Do you want me to just...
Yeah, renew your motion. I think what we'll do is send this to where the direction it was headed, and then maybe it'll have a second move to another committee.
Okay, and I will look into that. Chair, members, I'd appreciate your support of House File 2881 to be referred to Transportation Finance.
As amended,
and again, it's so important to have the people that are driving the vans for these people in all kinds of weather, in all kinds of conditions, to be of the highest standards so that everybody's lives are protected to the best of our ability. So again, please refer this to Transportation Finance. Thank you.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Hold the same sign. Okay, we'll go to Transportation Finance with consideration that it may move to another committee from there. Huh? We're going to have to wait a few minutes. Dr. Hansen is presenting a bill in another committee.
What's going about here? No, he hired that after I did. Who or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
This one?
Yeah,
yeah.
Not what I can tell here.
Mr. Bagnoli, I see that you're sitting way back in the corner. Is there any reason for that? You're not being friendly today. You want to turn around and face the corner, or what?
That is really terrible.
Yeah, on vacation.
Actually, Morton is CD 16.
watching. So she has to be
at least controversial at all.
We thought it was really good.
Well, they didn't like
for what it's worth, here to we.
Do you have a comment?
I don't think it's a point for all of us.
So, but it's not.
Did I state the case?
So I'm going to go there, which is only
enough.
It's from my home.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about
home.
Let's read this.
It's about I just think it's a little bit.
What?
And so I thought, well, come home from jackpot.
Yeah, we're in the
just, and given who knows how long I'm going to be here
today. Exactly.
For the rest area?
So I thought, well, I might as well stay.
Oh, for the target.
Where do we go with this? Where was
transportation
this?
Finance.
A little bit different.
That is. That is.
Yeah.
You're one of the co-authors.
So.
Say house file 28 or whatever. To freak out.
But it's not a funeral, so we might as well say that, right?
You still here. I can't think you would say it. It does. It's a general fund.
I know it is. I don't want to.
What?
Well, maybe I'll run downstairs. Do you think I heard that?
Lockhorn. Cartoon the Lockhorn.
You know, you guys will never talk. You're sitting at opposite ends of the of the row.
You know, from a magazine or she says it says here, Leroy, that
I didn't say it.
Jimmy, Jimmy, longer
the sides of the
chair. Yeah, right.
You guys
is there anything in there saying they want to?
No, I think are you working on your password?
Yeah. Just bring that on the little one.
Black
and
white. I'm going to go check
in.
Metaphorical analogy.
Okay.
So what's going on? Why can't she do it?
I'll be right back. There's
just.
Well, I got
you. I'm going to say something. Well, what the hell? Bill is on.
I'm to the minute.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying
that. You got some calls from some consistent. Oh, I don't know. Hold on. You can't get people back. We know how he is.
Don't say that.
He's coming down there.
Huh?
But they're not. They're not restructured.
You got an auditor for this?
Is it enforceable?
Is he the is he the chair?
Anyway, business owners that
tell him to come up so we can do his bills and then go back.
Yeah, so there are ways.
Where were you going last night for dinner?
For drinks.
Oh, what's around there? CC tab? Yeah, I know this because when I drive, I used to go there all the time. When I drive back, that's on the one way 26.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, what is it? Oh, yeah, it was. When you're only on Lake Street there, I mean on Franklin. So. Oh, good. Well, I think it's 26-28. Is that the one we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, that's the one I'd like to go first, is the watercraft decontamination.
Okay, I would move that 26-28 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Transportation and Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a relatively short bill. It's actually an amendment that I have moved a couple times or tried to move on the floor. And it's we have had an issue with aquatic invasive species for a long time. what this bill does is says, and we have seen through its process going through the policy committee of environment, we took out waste. So looking at rest areas that already exist as a location for decontamination, this would provide an opportunity for motorists who are carrying their boats to go in and check the affordable decontamination stations available. It's just kind of a common sense that transportation and natural resources work together to provide something for Minnesotans and those folks coming into the state to check their boats for AIS. So that's the bill. And I have a testifier here.
Are you still getting resistance from the DNR? I thought didn't you take out something in this bill that would make it feasible for them? Or
Mr. Chair, I took out weigh stations because okay. If you think about rest areas and weigh stations along the roads have a relatively short in and out access. Yeah. And so let's think about it, opening a fishing opener. If you had a number of motorists pulling in there, you could clog the weigh station on a busy freeway. That's a safety concern. Many of the weigh stations have been dismantled, so even the sites I had thought potentially, but the ones I'm familiar with, it's a relatively small in and out of those way stations, and just think about during a busy time when you pull in. And I think that was, we had testimony from the Highway Patrol about safety, so I took that out. Rest areas, they have longer ingress and egress. You have usually parking for semis and parking for cars. You usually have a bigger area where this could occur.
But they still want to say that they're still saying there's a charge or a cost or something.
I don't believe we have a fiscal note on this bill. Is that correct?
I don't know if the fiscal note came because of the rest areas, because I thought I heard him talk about that. Sure.
Mr. Chair and members, I did request a fiscal note for this bill. It's not ready for the policy committee yet, but in conversations with MnDOT, they indicated there may be trunk highway cost for way stations. I can't speak for the agency, but...
Okay. You know, they want to rent the rest areas to these folks. Right? No, we don't know. Okay. So we can send it to... Okay. Are there testifiers? Oh, I see one. Mr. Forrester.
Yes, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. And we've been working on AIS issues for a number of years now. One of the problems, I serve on the AIS Advisory Committee and have been involved in this issue since 2009 pretty deeply. If I had a boat that was infested, I don't know where I would go. We have 20-some-odd decontamination stations in the state, but they're portable, and so no one knows where they are. And this seems like a pretty common-sense, easy solution to at least get some of these decontamination units up in places that people are familiar with, that they have easy access to, beginning the conversation between the Department of Transportation and the Department of Natural Resources seems like low-hanging fruit. To us. I did drive out west last year and saw this model in practice in other places, and it was really easy. And another big piece of AIS is education, and so by having this sort of activity at rest areas, people will get a clear view as to what's involved. It will demystify the process. They can get information on how they can prevent the spread of AIS. So we support this bill.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, as I'm thinking about even your comments on the rest areas, the way stations, I'm sorry, I don't have a boat, and I have never been pulled over in a DNR check site, but when they put these up, do they just sieve out every boat that's coming down the pike, or how is this going to work? Is it from a safety perspective? That is an issue, and I'm thinking about the weigh stations on 35 as I run north and south to see Mom and Dad. Frequently, there's signage on those, and frequently if there are a lot of trucks and things start backing up the off-ramp, they'll switch the highway signage and let trucks bypass when the station is full. until they have space again, then they'll flip it back on and trucks begin diverting again. Do you anticipate DNR working to this level of cooperation with the Department of Transportation so that if the weigh station is full, they can just let people go on up the highway? It'd be more of a spot check kind of thing then?
Mr. Chair, if you look at the bill, really what we're saying is that these two agencies shall cooperate in an effort to use rest areas where feasible. They may find that it's not feasible. But we're directing them to start talking with each other to do this. So I would hope we wouldn't have had to do this with a bill, but we did. So I would hope that they would talk together about this, look at it, and see how they can make this happen.
Mr. Chair, that answers my second question, why is a bill necessary? But if we have to mandate cooperation, it reminds me of my mom putting my brother and me in a room and telling us to work it out. But we'll check back next year, Representative Hans, and see how that's working for us. But thank you for the effort.
Call this mom's rule. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay, I think it's pretty simple, so we can just take a shot at moving. Recommend again 26-28 be referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Now we go next to House File 2591. Representative Hanson.
I would ask if there's any bill. I am being motioned, but I need it for a vote in another committee. So if there's another, am I the last one on this?
You're the last one.
What this bill is simply to, it's not an affinity plate. My intent here is that the license plate would serve as your park badge. So it's a way of, instead of having seven stickers on your vehicle, you actually would have the plate be your pass. I'm well aware of the committee's history of not wanting additional plates, but I would think of this as a plate pass rather than another plate. And it sets up the thing that I have the bill written on,
special
upfront dollars. That's really a finance committee question where I think the bill goes next. The idea here is to make it easier for the consumers and for the agency. You have the bill, you drive at the park. Instead of hopping out and getting your sticker, you've already paid for it up front. It's on the plate. You just look at your plate, you go in. And I want to make sure the plate is clear so that our friends in law enforcement are able to read it. So that's the bill. And I know there are testifiers from the agencies, and I know there's a fiscal note. And I would ask if anybody... Do I have any co-authors in this?
Mr. Chair, I'm here.
Yes, Representative Runbeck is here. So, Representative Runbeck, could you carry it from here?
I can certainly do that.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? If I understand it correctly, you're going to make a sticker that goes on the license plate available for. Is that what we're not making a new license plate?
It would be a new license plate. It would be a park plate, like they have done for Reinvest in Minnesota. They have a pheasant and a deer, but this would be a park plate. But the park plate would be the permit to get into the park.
This is going to another finance committee.
That's correct.
Are there any other questions or comments? Is there anybody here testify for or against in the audience?
I'm Tom Evans from Driving Vehicle Services. I'm just here if Director McCormick asked me to attend if you had any questions or concerns about the license plate.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder if there'd be any savings if there's enough people who, access parks, one time for a period of whatever. Over 10 years, maybe they're savings, I don't know.
We buy these plates and they last then for the length of a license plate, and they pay the extra fee at that time for the park fee. Is that the deal?
Right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
My name is Luke Skinner, for the record. I'm the Deputy Director for Parks and Trails at DNR.
Yes.
The way it's set up right now, it does increase the amount that you'd be above a park pass. But it's a one-time fee right now. So in the short end of the first 5 years, there is an increase in revenue, which does help the park. But after that, it doesn't. So it's so there is that. That's one of the purposes of the of I think the way it comes to hands are laid out for that. Gives that, but it's also one time. So we're working with the authors and what the financing would be there. Long term versus just in the short term.
Don't we purchase plates every 7 years? Or?
Yes, Chairman. The plates are replaced every 7 years. The way I read this bill, though, you would just pay a duplicate plate fee, the $10. You wouldn't repay the $125.
But you'd only buy this at the 7 year.
You could buy it at any time.
Oh,
and
okay.
After 7 years, when you needed another plate, you would buy it for $10 rather than paying $125. So it would be a lifetime pass to the parks.
If the park fee should change, would you adjust your fees then? I mean, you may go to $20.
No, my understanding is you pay the $125 up front. And then you'd never be required to pay another fee to access the park as long as you display those plates.
Is that a multiple of the annual park fee? Is that how we arrived at $125 or what?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how the number was arrived at. Annual park pass right now is $25. So after 5 years, then after 5 years, then that. You gain what's there, and then after that, then it's free for the. So they're basically paying it off over 5 years of annual park pass, what it costs right now.
Representative Sundin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the DES personnel. If you sell your car, do you take your plate off and take that with you, or what would be the procedure there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the bill, there's a procedure to allow you to transfer the plate to another vehicle for a cost of $5.
Okay. So
the rights to that plate would transfer to your new vehicle. Or conceivably it could be sold with the vehicle. The person getting the new plate would benefit that way.
That's another can of worms, isn't it? I mean, we've got some states, I think, that transfer their plates with the person rather than with the car. Am I correct there?
Yes.
That's what we're talking about here.
Wisconsin, you would be able to, plates are assigned to the person rather than subject to a vehicle. In Minnesota, the plates stay with the vehicle unless they fall into one of the categories that allows for transfer. Some special plates.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, as I'm thinking of the different areas to ferret out here that go beyond transportation policy, and certainly the revenue to the parks is one. So I'm thinking that after transportation finance, this bill will probably be making its way, I would assume, to a committee that has jurisdiction over that, because I think that's a problem to be solved. I don't think it's unsolvable. I think it certainly is a fixable deal, but probably not in this committee. But I trust that if this bill leaves here and makes it trans finance, we'll be working on the length of plate and whether or not we want them to re-up when they, rather than get a $10 plate at 7 years, maybe we ought to start vetting those things in transportation finance and then in environment finance, probably. Just some suggestions for the process.
I wonder, should we go to transportation finance or should we go to environment? Why don't we send it to environmental, natural, and ag finance, and if transportation finance wants to look at it, we can do that. Anybody else have any questions or comments? In the audience, anybody else? Okay, well.
Chairman, has anybody moved the bill?
I think I did. But if I haven't, I would recommend that House File 2591 be referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance. Representative Rodrick was supposed to take charge of that, but she forgot. Okay. All in favor? All in favor of that?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign? Done. Okay.